the Bothell-based biotech firm Oncogenex, is on the road to getting its prostate cancer treatment drug on the market.
Getting a drug approval could be a long and expensive process, one that some say can hinder innovation and development. So how does that affect companies and patients?
David Hyde talked to Luke Timmerman. He's national biotech editor of Exconomy about the drug approval process. Luke Timmerman started by explaining the drug Oncogenex is testing.
The first thing you should know is that it's a very specific drug that hones in on a protein that scientists believe helps tumors resist chemotherapy. So the thought at Oncogenex is if we give this drug in combination with chemotherapy, it will make the chemo more effective.
And how do they go about getting this drug approved by the FDA?
It's a very long process, and drugs can get tripped up any number of points along the way. It's sort of like how a bill becomes law, if you think of that as one analogy. But it'll start when a scientist has an idea like the one I just described, and he synthesizes a molecule to hit that target. And chemists will fiddle around with an atom here, a bond there, to try to make it optimized against that target and so it doesn't hit too many other molecular targets like that in the body. And once they've got it in good shape, they'll test it in animals, mice, rats, sometimes dogs, monkeys, a process that could go 5 full years before it even gets into a human being in clinical trials.
And when does the FDA get involved and how?
It's really at that point when a company feels they've got something ready to go into clinical trials.
All right, it's a 3-stage process. What is the FDA looking at when they start to review these drug trials?
So, like you say, there are 3 phases, 1, 2, and 3. And in phase one, it's really just these are the first human beings getting exposed to the drug, and all they're trying to do is determine if it's safe and at a variety of doses. So they call it dose escalation. And it's start low, go slow is one of the mottos you hear. And that way, if they can see there's some toxicity, they can pull the plug on the drug before anybody really gets seriously harmed. Assuming the drug appears safe in phase one, in maybe a dozen or 2 dozen patients, the company will continue into the next phase, which is designed in a much more rigorous way to determine whether the drug is effective. And so the drug will be tested in maybe 100 patients now in a longer fashion, a more expensive fashion, at usually more than 1 or 2 sites around the U.S., maybe 10 or 20. And patients will be randomly assigned to get the new drug or the standard of care, typically.
We're talking to Luke Timmerman about a company, Oncogenex, that's in phase 3 of this 3-stage FDA approval process for a prostate cancer drug that they've been working on. Did they face any major challenges along the way?
Not really. A drug that makes it to phase 3 is showing pretty good signs of safety and effectiveness. And in the phase 2, like I was just describing, their drug showed that it could extend survival time of advanced prostate cancer patients by a median of about 7 months over the standard of care. So this was an exciting finding. It was presented at a medical meeting and was the basis for a much longer, more aggressive phase 3 trial, which is the one that's just wrapping up now. Oncogenex enrolled 1,000 patients, not just here in the U.S., but around the world, onto this drug and compared it to standard of care. And we don't have the results yet, so we don't really know if they've been able to confirm that benefit that was seen in the earlier study. That's something we'll find out in the middle of this year.
Luke Timmerman is here telling us about the company Oncogenex and in general about the FDA approval process for new drugs, in this case a prostate cancer drug that they're working on. How does the approval process affect the way companies like Oncogenex actually innovate?
Well, it's a very long and expensive process. From the moment they started their first clinical trial to the day they could win FDA approval, it's probably at least 10 years and maybe 15. So the company throughout that process needs to raise lots and lots of money and recruit lots of investors just to keep people interested throughout the various steps along the way. That was probably their biggest challenge in the early going, And now they've raised the money, they've spent it on this trial, and it's a matter of really waiting for the results.
How risky is it for investors?
Oh, extremely. The risk does go down as you get further along. So most compounds will fail in phase one after a little amount of time and a little amount of money has been spent. But it's fairly common, actually, for drugs to still fail in phase three, even after you think you've got a really good result there from phase two, that the drug appears to be extending lives. Often things change when you enroll many more patients. You might see some unpredicted side effect appear that kills the drug. Or maybe it's just not as effective in larger numbers of patients.
So in general, what's your assessment of just how this process works through stage one and two, let's say?
Well, it's still probably too long and too expensive and too risky for most people's liking. In the investment community and in the medical community, we'd all like to have more confidence that when a drug goes in its first 10 patients, that we have a good sense of whether it's a real medical advance or not. And the reality is biology is just extremely complicated. There's a lot we don't know. And those kind of failures still happen after years and years of time and effort and money.
So if investors and scientists want somebody to blame, they have to basically blame human biology, suppose the FDA?
Well, there will be people who will blame the FDA at the end of the day when it could be that the standards for approval may have changed. The standard of care may have changed in all of those years. So sometimes a company can get all the way through the process and feel like they've done everything right. But then a competitor came along the way and raised the bar. And so then the FDA will raise the bar and say, a 3-month survival improvement is no longer good enough. We need to see 6 months, say. And that could wreck a drug, destroy a company.
Wow. So sometimes the FDA is actually moving the goalposts, as they say in sport metaphor land.
People actually use that term, yeah.
All right. And just to bring it back full circle to Oncogenix and the cancer drug that they're working on, how far away are they from final approval from the FDA?
So they have to get the phase three results from this 1,000-patient study. They say they expect that in the middle of this year. Presuming those are positive and that they confirm what was seen in the earlier trials, it would take another 9 months or so to get their whole application ready to go in electronic form, send it to the FDA, and then it's probably another 8 to 12 months for the FDA to review it before it reaches the market.
What do they do to get this drug into the hands of doctors and patients?
So it's a delicate dance of drug marketing. The first thing they would do is arrange for all of the data that they put in front of the FDA to be published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, like the New England Journal of Medicine, hopefully. Something really prominent that a lot of doctors read and take seriously. They would also present all the data at a big medical meeting. So you get all the cancer doctors at their big convention and try to get a big splash in front of a room of maybe 1,000 cancer doctors and show off how good your drug is.
So that sounds like any academic conference. They're just there talking about this new drug.
Yeah, every professional society of doctors gets together, has an annual meeting, and they all want to hear what's new to help their patients.
Is there anything kind of to give it more pizzazz than you'd picture it at your average paleontology conference, for example?
Well, the presentations themselves can be pretty data-driven and dry, but these are also sort of becoming trade shows. So the company will have a booth with a fancy logo of the company and give away pens and maybe a latte for the doctors who stop by. So that's sort of where the pizzazz comes in.
And what's next in the process?
So once they have spread the word in the medical community about their drug, then the sales reps really go out into the field. And these are people that hang around in hospitals, doctor's offices, try to get a few minutes of their time to give them the elevator pitch, so to speak, about their new drug and how it's it helps their patients, and they ought to give it a chance and prescribe it.
We were talking earlier about a company, Oncogenix, that's in the process. They're in stage two of the three-part process of getting their cancer drug actually approved. But is there an example of a Seattle-based company that's gotten to this stage that can shed some light on this for listeners?
There have been a few. One good recent example is Seattle Genetics. They got approval of a drug for Hodgkin's disease and another rare lymphoma a couple of years ago. And they've done quite well in the market, hitting their sales goals.
So how did Seattle Genetics do it?
So they did some of those things that I just mentioned. In their case, I believe it was the first new drug for either of these cancers in more than 40 years. And all of these patients really just have standard chemo at their late relapsed stage of disease. So I think this was a case where, and they had really good clinical data. They sailed through the FDA. There was no controversy among the advisors to the FDA. I think it won a 10-0 recommendation in favor of approval. I think this is one of those rare cases of a drug that, I mean, the company may object to this, but that sold itself.
Oh, wow. So there's a range, it sounds like. How do they get doctors to prescribe the drugs if it's not such an open and shut case?
Well, there are many more competitive areas of medicine. Prostate cancer is one where there are three or four companies out there with sales reps aggressively hounding doctors, trying to convince them that theirs is the new state of the art. So that complicates things.
How so?
Well, because doctors are skeptical people by nature, and they want to see really hard, convincing evidence before they'll change their habits. And then beyond that, they want to see that it actually works and helps their patients. Like a few anecdotal cases that verify in their minds what the data say go a long way toward forming a prescribing habit.
So this is just part of our larger capitalist system, basically, right? It works similar to other kinds of industries. I guess ultimately the question is, how does it affect patients? How does it affect doctors' ability to practice medicine?
Well, there are a lot of differences in how this capitalist system works. I mean, for one thing, the patient is not really the consumer. The drug company is selling that drug to the physician, and the physician makes that key decision on whether to buy or not buy. And then beyond that, you have insurance companies that are the ones who pay for the drug. So they decide to pay or not to pay, or how much we really want to pay, in terms of do we want to pay less than the company is asking. And that becomes a negotiation sometimes. So the patient is a bit further removed from a lot of these classic economic decision-making points that you and I have when we decide to buy a book on Amazon. I mean, we're the consumer. We decide what to buy. It's not quite that way in healthcare.
How would you characterize the process of drug marketing in the United States?
The system has its problems. There are we have runaway costs, which we alluded to earlier. You don't really have that consumer, that patient acting as the consumer, watching his own checkbook. So that's part of the problem. You also have companies, there have been many examples of companies that have bent the law and broken the law by over-promoting their drugs for what are known as off-label uses. So when a drug gets approved by the FDA for a certain disease, like say Hodgkin's disease, that's all it's supposed to be prescribed for. But once it's on the market, a doctor can decide to prescribe it for something else. What can't happen, though, is that drug makers are not supposed to promote that something else. And oftentimes they do anyway, because it's very lucrative. So there have been many Department of Justice investigations and fines paid by big pharma companies who went too far in their marketing. They promoted uses of drugs that were not thoroughly tested and approved by the FDA. And I hope and I think that the industry is sort of self-policing and beginning to clean up its act. We're seeing some evidence of that. But there's drug marketing has a ways to go before it becomes sort of what you alluded to earlier, like a classic efficient economic system.
One of the questions, I guess, for patients, they're not consumers, but they're patients of who are getting prescribed these drugs, is are drugs being overprescribed? In other words, let's take the field of psychiatry. Sometimes people will say, look, the talking cure can be effective, but oftentimes psychiatrists are relying on drugs when they may otherwise, you know, work on other methods. I mean, have you looked at that question, and what do you think?
I think that's a real issue, and it's something that each medical society needs to really wrestle with. So I don't think anybody would say that the FDA should keep these psychiatric drugs off the market because there's a high placebo effect, right? You hear people say that some of these antidepressants, for example, they appear to work even though 40% of the time you can give people a sugar pill and that works. Well, the fact is that some people really are helped by the antidepressants. And then it becomes more of a question in among the physicians. Are they being judicious in who they prescribe these to and what other things they might try first? Are they a little too trigger happy to just immediately write that prescription and assume that every problem people have can be solved through a pill? Well, maybe that isn't always the case.
I mean, what kinds of incentives do physicians have to either overprescribe or underprescribe or prescribe correctly, if that's the three options, given the current system? You know, are there a lot of reasons why they might decide to overprescribe drugs, or some physicians might decide to prescribe drugs when otherwise they might seek another treatment?
In the case of cancer, you have what a lot of people consider to be an incentive to overprescribe drugs, because it's a rare medical discipline in which doctors actually earn part of their pay from a percentage of the drug cost. So in the case of a psychiatrist, he can write a prescription for an antidepressant, and that doesn't affect how much money he takes home. But an oncologist who prescribes a $50,000 chemotherapy regimen actually will get 6% of that amount that goes directly into his practice, into his pocket. And so there has been a movement afoot within oncology to change this system and try to make sure that the doctors are getting paid some other way. But that's how it's been for many years, and that's how it remains today.
You'd sort of think the check on that would be the insurance companies, because they're the ones that ultimately have to pay the price, right? Why wouldn't they say, hey, hold on, this is overprescription of drugs?
Well, in the case of cancer, it's very difficult for an insurance company to say, no, you shouldn't prescribe that drug to a dying patient. It's a very tough ethical position for them to be in, and not one they really are. It's not a battle they're really willing to fight. The drug development system is still immensely time-consuming, costly, and risky. And until we find a better way to deeply understand the biology of what goes wrong at the level of genes and cells in people with disease versus people who are healthy, until we really have a much deeper understanding of that fundamental thing, this is the system that we're left with.